Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the 10th conversation of the Play to Potential podcast series. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. In each conversation, I talk to an accomplished individual and discuss their perspectives on leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is Avneesh Bajaj. Avneesh has been an investment banker with Goldman Sachs in the US, an entrepreneur at Bazi that he successfully sold to eBay subsequently, and a venture investor at Matrix Partners India for more than a decade. In our chat, we spoke about how Avneesh thought about the key pivotal moments in his life, his perspectives on entrepreneurship, venture investing as a career, and much, much more. So without further ado, over to the conversation. Avneesh, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Deepak.
And at the outset, congrats on the wonderful exit, 20x exit on Ace23, was it?
Yeah, it's an online gaming company. It's 32x to be accurate in rupee terms, but yes, in dollar terms. And thank you.
Wonderful. So Avneesh, again, this conversation is about your journey through the various avatars you held. So maybe a good place to pick up the plot is rewinding the clock. Rather, when you graduated from Harvard Business School in 98, you joined Goldman Sachs. I noticed that you'd done your summer internship at McKinsey, which is where I spent a little bit of time in the US. So I'm always curious, in a lot of ways in B-School, both Goldman Sachs and McKinsey go after a similar pool of people at some level in terms of the high achievers. So how did you think about consulting versus banking at that juncture?
So I would say, and we'll come to the Bazi story later. If you look at my history, I was checking almost all the boxes, right? Mm-hmm. Went to Delhi Public School, went to IIT, mm-hmm. wanted to go to Stanford or Berkeley, didn't get in. So went to Wisconsin, went and worked at Apple. So I'm a brand collector and degree collector, right? Then I went to Harvard. So McKinsey and Goldman had to be, the boxes had to be checked. Once I interned at McKinsey, and I, by the way, at Matrix, we have a bunch of people from McKinsey, as you know. I think it's a great institution and it brings a lot of training and learning that others don't. But I realized very quickly it wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. I would have gone to McKinsey if I couldn't get into Goldman. And by the way, there's another side of maybe the personality. It's almost unheard of to get into a Goldman Sachs with no background in finance. So for me, that was a challenge. Mm-hmm. The most sought after office in Goldman at the time was the high-tech group in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. That was the most sought after. So I had to go after that. That is just how I'm built. Also, when I was at McKinsey, I realized that strategy pushed me into structuring common sense better. Mm-hmm. Goldman, I had no clue what I would learn, because I felt that it was a technical subject of which I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. So for me, that also became a reason to go after that. And the money was going to be better. Hmm. So it's nothing more profound than that.
But with the wisdom of hindsight, would you have done it any differently if you went back to that decision point?
No, I wouldn't have started Bazi without having been at Goldman, because I was part of the team that took eBay public. Hmm. That's how I understood that. If you ask me, until then, I had not understood the power of the internet as a geography leveling medium. Mm. I had understood internet as a distribution channel. Mm-hmm. Yahoo was there with news, you know, obviously with search. So it was a content search engine. Correct. Netscape was there. I was in that era. I was in that era, right? The fact that eBay woke me up to the fact that people across geographies can actually transact on this medium, that to me was a blinding insight. Mm-hmm. And that actually, at that moment, frankly, it came to me that some of these models are going to be far bigger than the content push models, the ones that connect either people or geographies. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't have learned any of that if I wasn't at Goldman. A, B, I would say there is an element of an edge that the Wall Street banks have, which I would say the consulting firms are, and I don't know how best to put it, but a notch lower in it. Maybe it's the aggression. It is the Wall Street culture. The fact that my lifestyle would matter, you know, absolutely would be at the bottom of the priorities for any of the people at Goldman. And even if they knew something could be done on Tuesday, they'll give it to me on Friday evening because that's a rite of passage. I actually really, really learned a lot from them. I think it brought us, it kind of was the cherry on top of the HBS education, which I think made me a lot more confident. Also, very early, this happens at McKinsey also. I was advising Disney, or Goldman was advising on the Disney-Infoseek merger. And there was this moment where I was with Michael Eisner, Tom Staggs is CFO, the partner on the deal, and me. Four people having a private dinner in one of the fancy restaurants in New York. I mean, a lot of those things give you a lot more confidence. And looking at those people and saying, you know what, they are great, but, you know, it's not like I can't ever imagine myself being that.
It sort of puts you on the same playing field almost.
Yeah.
And about a year and a half, you came back to start Bazi.com. I think you began to talk about it. The question was going to be, what triggered it? It looks like it was the eBay taking it to public, which was a trigger, was it, for you to come and start Bazi?
No, it wasn't. I would say at HBS we had done, so entrepreneurship was highly desirable as a career for me. Which, looking at my own background, which my father, we've grown up as central government, middle class kind of background, was not very obvious. And if I think back today, I wouldn't have never acknowledged it at that time. It was just, I wanted to get rich quick, but on my own terms. I didn't want to work for anybody to do that, but I did want to get rich quick. So entrepreneurship seemed to fulfill both those objectives. Get rich and on your own terms. So I actually struggled in systems like Goldman even because, you know, following instruction doesn't come easily to me, as my wife will also say. So at HBS, we had done a field study. We came to India. We were looking to start a IT services firm. And I came and met Mr. Narayan Murthy. I went and met Mr. Ashank Desai of Mastek. We went and set up all these meetings, which they were kind enough to do, to really understand what niche we could get and focus on and build an IT services business.
As part of an HBS project, was it?
As part of the HBS project, we did that field study because we actually wanted to potentially do that right after HBS. So this entrepreneurship bug was there. After that trip to India, I decided I didn't want to come back to India. And I didn't want to do that kind of business. Two reasons. Didn't feel much of a buzz in India, frankly. Felt very old school, very, you know, for somebody who had been in the US for maybe only 5-6 years, it just still felt like a huge gap. And second, felt that the IT services business was a body shopping business. And it was about visa management, which we didn't want to do. It was a body shopping, visa management, logistics business. Heard some horror stories about how people would fly over there and then call a friend of mine had started a small IT services business, get a call at weird hours saying, how do you work the shower and stuff? Didn't want to do that, right? From the people that were fresh off the boat. So, therefore, went with Goldman, as we discussed earlier. But this bug never stopped. So I had met Suvir, my co-founder at HBS. We had kept in touch. He was at BCG in New York. We used to keep thinking about business ideas. And remember, this is dot-com bubble days.
Yep.
So we kept churning through idea after idea. And then it all kind of came together when we moved back to India, we didn't have this eBay idea. It was one of the ideas. The call at that time became that Suvir had come to India for some project in late 99. He knew that I was very close to, you know, saying, I want to do something. But India was not in the consideration set.
Very interesting.
I was actually looking to potentially join a company in Latin America and run their Latin American portal, which, by the way, the whole life path would have been different. Office in Rio, office in New York. And I had gone through multiple rounds of interviews with that company. Mm-hmm. So then he called. Then one of my seniors had come back to India to start a venture firm. His name is Ashish Dhawan from Chris Capital. He called and he had done this whole Brazil gig in his earlier life. And he said, look, I've been there, done that. This is the time to come to India. To be fair, so I sometimes thank him and sometimes blame him for making me make the move, because the alternate was Rio and New York. Mm. So it was a combination of that. And then there was a personal side to it. My dad had Parkinson's through most of the 90s, and it was getting at it to an advanced stage. Mm. And I could sense my sister was actually moving the other way. She was going to move to Canada. So when you put it all together, it just felt like the right move.
But when you moved geographies, the Bazi.com idea hadn't taken shape.
It was me and Suvir had shaken hands, and we had said we would do something, and there were five ideas.
Very interesting.
One of which was auctions, one of which was essentially a redev but more youth-focused, one of which was city-focused portals. By the way, over the next 6, 8, 9 months, all of those ideas were launched by somebody or the other, because it was happening everywhere in the world. Mm. So yeah, there were five. And then, that said, given the experience, by the way, eBay, if you go and check, actually listed in late 98 and did a secondary in 99. And that model was doing really, really well. The results would come out. So as we had come here, I would say probably in like a month or 6 weeks, we narrowed down on the auctions idea.
Very interesting. But having said that, I'm just sort of going back to that moment in time, let's say having the chat with your boss in Goldman Sachs and not having an alternate in hand. That must have been a hard plunge to take.
Yes, I would say probably one of the situations where when I look back, I wonder whether it was thought through. When I landed in India, it definitely felt like it wasn't thought through, because we also realized there were no internet users in India, although there were hoardings everywhere. So yeah, I would say, and not just with my boss at Goldman, with my father, who, like I said, was central government. He's like, you are giving up a job that is going to make you $200,000. And I was in debt, by the way. Mm. I came to India with $85,000 of debt. And he said, what are you doing? Now, there was one piece that I missed along the way. There was one guy who, as we were churning through different ideas, we used to reach out to. His name was Scott Murphy, subsequently became a US senator. And he, when I finally went to him, he said, Avnish, I've seen you make so many business plans. I know you can use Word and PowerPoint really well. I don't know if you have the balls to actually take the plunge. And I said, well, if I do, I don't have the money. And he said, okay, walk with me. And we walked to his office. I thought it was just going to be a mentoring chat. He went in, took out his checkbook and said, how much?
Wow.
And, so he wrote down a check for $20,000. Which I used to buy the plane ticket, laptop, because he knew I was in debt. And he said, I'm sure you'll be fair to me. No discussion of terms. And he said, I'm sure you'll be fair to me when, you know, if and when you start something, give me equity.
Trust.
Huh? And he made at exit 12x or 13x his money. And I remember his wife calling me and thanking me, saying, we just bought the apartment next door, or we did something to the apartment next door. This is that return.
And sometimes these small, one is the what the money is worth, but also psychologically such
absolutely.
A
absolutely. I don't think without that, like you said, not just the check, but that confidence and also the kick that you are very good with PowerPoint and Word. Will you actually do something?
Somebody who provokes you, right?
Yeah. Like, okay.
Got it. And just moving forward, Avnish. Again, Bazi.com, and then the bubble burst very quickly, right, around 2000. So walk us through that phase. And the reason I ask is, again, there's enough discussions that happen around entrepreneurs having resilience. But I'm always curious about what does that mean? How does it get really tested? And how does it show up? So maybe if you could talk us through.
Yeah, I think I'll give a little bit more context prior to that, because I think it applies to any entrepreneur who actually, you know, who happens to listen to this.
Sure.
I always say I never rule out the role of luck, but I also say luck is, you know, the cliche preparation meeting opportunity. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at after we landed, we raised $21 million at a valuation of, I don't know, few hundred crores within 6 to 8 weeks with 3 rounds of funding, including the last round being led by News Corp. And that goes, when you have a lot of money, resilience comes easier. The point I'm trying to make is there were enough people at that stage who were saying, why do you need it? Why do you need to do this? And to me, one of the core reasons Bazi survived, other than the fact that, you know, we may have learnt on the job and done a great job over a period of time, was that we had raised enough money. Mm. Right? So to me, a strong balance sheet gives you strategic flexibility. Mm. And often people miss this. They, especially in India, they try to over-optimize along the way. So we got lucky. We raised a lot of money, but that's because we also were very good with PowerPoint and Word, and we could, you know, we had been preparing for a long period of time. As soon as we saw the opportunity, we jumped on it. And there's a theme that plays out with Bazi over a period of time. After that, I would say the second place where part luck, part what we did, and I would give Suvir also credit for this quite a bit, is we had built a very good, strong, solid team very early. Mm-hmm. And this was before the bubble burst. The fact that they joined us before the bubble burst, maybe not a big deal, you know, and we were getting talked about a lot of money raised. The fact that we managed to retain them through the worst of times, and not just them, all of Bazi over 3.5-4 years, total involuntary attrition was 10%.
And how did you do that?
It was a family culture. So by the way, when eBay acquired us, they did a market benchmarking. And the average salary went up 40%.
Wow.
So, but people made a lot of money. Our ESOPs went all the way down to the office boy. So that's just a financial way of doing it.
Sure.
There are a lot of non-financial ways of building that ownership. These were still the days where I remember I used to go to some offices and, when the founder promoter would walk in, people would stand up. We were on first names basis. So today all that is considered par for course. Mm-hmm. It was very unique at that time.
Sure.
And I was with the eBay India country manager earlier today, mm-hmm. and we were planning the Bazi reunion next month, mm-hmm. which happens every year where the attendance is 60-70% and people fly in globally. So I think managing to create that, it is no one single formula, but I think managing to make people, it was a meritocracy, no politics, open door, highly performance-oriented culture, yet caring, you know, and caring would come out in different ways. When somebody was having problems, mm-hmm. right from the top down, they would get help. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a very big part of us being resilient. So we had a bank balance and we had an emotional bank balance.
Got it.
Right? So both were there, mm-hmm. Which makes resilience easier. Then I would say we learned on the job with a very smart team, which was very open. We kept learning on the job and navigating the changing environment. Again, timed certain things, which I would think we should take credit for, where at the absolute bottom and the nadir of the bubble, of the bust, we acquired our only competitor at a very, very financially, attractive construct. And the market just happened to pick up 3-4 months later.
Very interesting.
And then it was, you know, then we were in a very good place.
Understood. And again, moving forward, Avnish, eBay bought you for $55 million. And again, back to your early point about, I want to get rich quick.
Yeah.
Again, this was an interesting point in time where you'd hit an important logical and a financial milestone.
Yeah.
And I'm always curious about how people reset their life or reset their goals when they hit such a point.
Yeah.
So how was it for you, that moment in time when...
It's a great question. It was actually one of the seminal moments in my life. So my goal was very openly articulated. I didn't want to make 1 million. I didn't want to make 10. I wanted to make 2 million. That was my goal.
This was at what point in time?
That was in 1999, 2000 when we started.
Got it.
We exceeded that by a few multiples. It wasn't 10, but it was, you know, close to it. So I was done.
Correct.
Financially. And also philosophically, even at that time, even when I wanted to get rich, the thought was very clear that money is the bridge between your needs and your means, right? Now what happens in life is the wants start faking themselves as needs.
Yeah.
right? And the wants never stop. Interestingly, the things that I thought I wanted, at the time I wanted to get rich, I never bought after I got rich, right? So such like as? A Ferrari, and okay. I mean, never got into cars. So it's amazing how those things change. But I remember after the sale, we had been invited to Como by eBay for a global thing. I'd gone with my wife. And I remember having this conversation with her, saying with the bank balance that we have, and assuming we don't invest it stupidly and take a yield of 10%, I don't need to ever work in my life.
Right.
And I'm wondering what I should do. And she said, please don't wonder. Don't sit on my head. You need to go. So, but on a serious note, I said, I have this framework I've always used in my life called passion, skill set, and opportunity. Mm-hmm. And you should work at the intersection of the three. And on that, there were other things like teaching. It's a very, very big passion for me. Mm-hmm. I believe I have the skill set, whether people believe it or not. Opportunity, who knows? Financially, no, but depends on how you define opportunity, because I can add a fourth circle to this, which is meaning, right? Mm. For me, it gives me a lot of meaning. Mm. So I had that discussion with her, and had that discussion with myself. And fast forwarding it a little bit, I guess after spending a little bit of time, reached the conclusion that I was still driven by more tangible forms of achievement, not money, but in a more traditional business sense, mm-hmm. Than making that switch to say just personal growth and impact. So that thought evolved. And along the way, because I had money, I started investing as an angel investor. And I must have made 15 investments. One of which, by the way, is ClearTrip. I was one of the founding angel investors. There were a few others that have been successful and a bunch that have not. Getting involved in ClearTrip, getting involved in another company called Pangea 3, which Reuters had bought later, I realized that I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And the passion, skill set, opportunity framework suddenly started becoming interesting towards investing. Mm. I realized I had a passion for it. I was enjoying it. I realized that I did have a skill set having been an entrepreneur. Mm. And now we'll talk about what the positives and negatives of that are.
Sure.
And there was clearly an opportunity, emerging opportunity in India. I mean, India didn't have really VC firms. So that's really what then said, okay, you know what, let me pursue this.
Got it. Very interesting, because at that point in time, some people go down the path of serial entrepreneurship, saying, now that I've cashed out, what's the next big business I can build?
Yeah.
So I was just curious about how you thought about another...
You know, I could give you a nicely sounding answer, but the reality is I was just fatigued. Mm-hmm. The Bazi journey was so tough. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the internet had not yet fully arrived. Mm-hmm. So if I look at the passion, skill set, opportunity, passion was dulled. Skill set was probably there. Opportunity was still a question mark, because which is why if you look at even the Matrix history, we started investing in tech in 2011-12. Mm-hmm. Before that, we have done maybe one or two investments.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, because we missed Flipkart, but did not invest in the 2007 bubble, did not invest in the 2010 bubble. Because having been in the trenches, I knew it was a bubble before it became obvious to everybody, right? Mm. So I was fatigued. That was one of the reasons. The second thing was, I realized that I was enjoying breadth plus some depth more than full depth, right? So working across different business lines, I'm really driven by intellectual stimulation.
Sure.
To one day go into a legal KPO business and be a thought partner and have that strategic discussion of saying what is the right thing here, and the next day go into a ClearTrip online travel and saying what is the right thing here,
sure.
I was enjoying that a lot more. So it was a combination of the two. I mean, truth be told, there were VCs. I still remember one which had done it with a lot of flamboyance, who came into the Bazi office, sat down and gave me a check. It said, pay to Avnish Bajaj $10 million, like fully printed out, saying whatever you want to do, we'll fund.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I knew enough about it by that time not to get carried away by all that theatrics.
So. Fair enough. Avnish, moving on, talking about VC investing. Once again, people arrive at this profession from different places. You have McKinsey consultants in your firm. There are entrepreneurs, there are bankers. So give us a sense of what it means to be an investor after being an entrepreneur. And the reason I ask is empathy is helpful, but sometimes intrusion is not. So how do you walk the tightrope of ensuring that you provide the support, but at the same time, you hold back so that you're not breathing down the shoulders? So
when you just gave all the answers. That's the issue. You have to walk the tightrope. So, you know, interestingly, there's obviously a few investors I respect. There's one in particular called Fred Wilson of Union Square Ventures. So the conventional wisdom in the US over the last 10 years, where obviously it's the most mature venture environment, and I would argue even in China, is that the operator investors make better investors, make better venture capitalists, better venture capitalists. So the people who have been operators in their life or entrepreneurs or some such thing. Interestingly, this guy just sent an email the other day and he said, if you look at me, meaning him, Mike Moritz of Sequoia, Bill Gurley of Benchmark, none of them have been operator investors. So there used to be a school of thought which used to say that, which was probably 10, 15 years ago, which said that the best investors in the world will have operating background, but the worst investors in the world will also be the operating background guys, right? And the others, the non-operating background guys will have lower beta and can still be great investors. The reason they would be the worst is exactly for the reasons you said. And the reason they would be best is also exactly for the reasons you said. That the reasons they can be best, they can empathize more, they can relate to situations more, they are able to give better strategic advice. They are able to give better operational advice. They are able to give better organizational advice. Everything. Because they've been there, done that. The negative is exactly the same reason. They tend to back themselves more. They tend to, instead of backing the best founder, they'll back their own thesis with the founder. They get in the middle of too many things. Things the founder should be doing, they would end up doing. So the right answer is to be able to figure that stuff out in your own brain and use the positive and not the negative. I think the best guys are able to do that. Now, if you look at the...
And actually, maybe if I could ask there, what are the one or two things that differentiates the two clusters, the one at the top and one at the bottom? What about the two clusters would you say would be different?
So it is not about the two clusters as such. I would say it's a much more philosophical answer. I think the philosophical answer is, in my view, this business in particular of venture investing can be learned but cannot be taught. So the question is, how self-aware are you? How much of the feedback loop is working for you? Where have you realized that maybe I was backing myself and not an entrepreneur? Where have you realized that you are getting your hands in the weeds and then it becomes your problem? I think the best guys figure it out. I have gone through that journey myself. I used to back myself. I used to be telling the entrepreneur, do this, do this, do this. The best returns I've made is when the entrepreneur tells me, no, 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 right? Because they know what they are doing. And frankly, if you ask me my own personal journey, the intellectual stimulation of working with somebody who's much smarter than you and is doing a much better job than you ever can is just a whole different level. So it's the self-learning loop that differentiates the two clusters. One cluster is self-learning. I use the term outside in, is getting signals. Mark Andreessen puts it very well that, you know, he has four or five people he looks up to. And any situation he's analyzing, those people are sitting on his shoulders and he's having arguments with them. These are the kind of people who are just constantly making themselves smarter by examining different angles, taking different points
of
view.
It's like a personal board of directors of
exactly.
all sorts, right?
Mentally, right? Versus people who are just very inside out, always very prescriptive, think they know the answers, don't, you know, collaborate. And I think that's what differentiates great investors from the not. So it's not as much operators versus not. Operators, because they have been there, have a higher tendency to be inside out because they think they know it. The good news about non-operators is they're very open. They don't know it. Operators have a higher tendency to fall into this trap of saying, I know the answers, let me prescribe, and so on and so forth.
So there's a natural tension built in, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because they come in with that sort of wiring. Fair enough. But talking about VC investing, in your experience, what are the typical things that are misunderstood about a career? What I'm always curious about is, you know, this whole grass is greener on the other side syndrome, right? A lot of people, you know, they get in with a certain set of assumptions, but they come in and discover that the career is, you know, slightly different. So in your experience, what are the things that take people by surprise typically?
Look, we are I would say Matrix is a little bit different in how we operate. So some of the comments I'm going to make are industry, and then I'm going to talk about Matrix. So I would say industry-wise, people feel that it's a lifestyle business. You know, it's a great lifestyle. How hard can it be? You get 2 and 20. You have a management fee coming. You know, you are the boss. You decide everything, all of that thing. You are the person investing. I don't think anybody joins Matrix with that delusion, because they're very clear. Our reputation is very clear that we work very hard. We are hustlers. And I think the team here works harder than some of the, you know, operating companies. So that cushy lifestyle thing is a big fallacy. Also, that I would say people don't realize how hard a business it is when you are putting your reputation and your money, but essentially handing it to somebody else with no control over it, right? Mm. And especially if you are a high achiever, type A person, who wants immediate gratification, immediate results, you have no control either over the timeline or over the exact path.
Hmm.
So neither the journey nor the destination nor the time, right? So that is very, very difficult.
Hmm.
Also what people, I would argue, if you just look at physical amount of work, maybe I would say in Matrix, physically speaking, I would work, in the hardest working year, same level as Bazi, but median year, maybe 80% of Bazi. Mental stress, 1.5x.
Wow.
All the time. Right? Because you don't have to, and you have so many balls in the air, so many things, that are going on. So I think those are the things that people don't realize. And I think the best people in this business, unfortunately actually age fast, right? Mm. Because there's a lot going on.
And the other piece I'm always curious about in investing is somewhere the lead time for feedback is also long.
That's what I said, gratification cycle, right?
Right. So how do you calibrate if you're doing right, if you're investing right? Let's say for somebody who comes in from the outside,
yeah,
till you've done your first exit and you've showcased, let's say, the cross-cycle success.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you?
So there are enough early indicators. There are enough early indicators. And again, like I said, you have to have that self-learning loop. Because if you have to wait till exit or write-off before factoring in those learnings into your next investment. I mean, Warren Buffett, I was just reading from this Omaha thing where it has been covered in a number of papers. I mean, him and Charlie Munger, Charlie is, I think, 93.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is, whatever, 86 or 90. And they still say they make mistakes and they learn.
Mm.
And I have seen enough 28-year-olds in this business who think that they know everything, or, you know, 30. Mm. I'm not talking about Matrix, because if they hear it, they'll think it's them. but I've seen enough of that, right?
Right.
So I think it comes back to, are you taking that learning loop? So how do I look at it? One of the early indicators of the success of a company, again, assuming it's a great founder, but how do you determine whether it's a great founder? Is, I would say, the best people meet or beat their commitments consistently. Now, in early stage, that doesn't mean that you have to hit every quarter. It's impossible.
Sure.
But the best guys that we have backed, there is an element, I would say, in life, in success, in businesses which are more ambiguous, which is investing as well as startups, of, I don't know if you've read this book called Super Forecasting. It's a great book. You should read it. It talks about anticipating issues.
Interesting.
And then kind of taking actions. And then, you know what? Lo and behold, everybody says, wow, this guy was such a visionary. He figured it out. But they are able to match patterns and do that. So how does that manifest itself? What they say will happen, happens. Right? If they say, I'm going to meet this number in this quarter, it'll happen. Now, given how hard and uncertain it is, it has to be like 3 or 4 strikes before you're out.
Mm.
So the way I see it is, a very early indicator for me in companies is the founder doing what he committed he will do? And over a 6-quarter time frame, if that is generally happening, that'll be a great result.
Mm.
Then I will take the feedback loop for myself, saying, what was I backing in this guy and how is that playing out?
Very interesting.
And let's say if it was the other way around, then one would say, you know, what did I back? What did I think was I backed in the guy, and where did I go wrong?
Hmm.
What could I have done differently? That's how you have to measure yourself, right? Now, there are other markers that come in. In our business, there are things like markups, you know. So now markups matter because when other investors are looking, assuming they're smart investors, most of them are, by the way. So if they are marking your company up, they are also seeing something that you saw. There is a validation because ultimately, when a company has to exit, it exits either as an IPO or an M&A. In either case, a lot of other people are seeing what you see. And you get markers of that along the way via markups and stuff like that, which to me are also indicators whether you're doing well or not.
Fair enough. Now, moving to the other side, Avnish, talking about entrepreneurs and talking about self-awareness and development. One of the things in startups is that the organization often outgrows the individual, right? Just in terms of the pace of change. So I'm always curious about both your personal journey in terms of how you scaled up your leadership muscle, if it were, as you were scaling up Bazi, and also as an investor at Matrix. In your experience with entrepreneurs, what do you see the good entrepreneurs do for them to scale up as leaders as the organization scales up?
Yeah. So I would say at the risk of sounding like a broken record, it's all about self-awareness and the willingness to be that, right? I remember 2002, I got an anonymous email at Bazi saying, effectively saying you suck as a leader. And
from within the company.
I'll go through the rest of the story. And there was also, I could see there was politics, negative culture. Now remember, this was close to the bottom of the cycle. So I remember calling an ant, all hands, and saying, hey guys, I don't know enough about how to do this. I'm in some cases younger than you. But if you're going to have this culture, and if we can't have the freedom to actually say these things openly to each other, then we have a bigger problem. We should all go home. I don't want to do this, right? I would appreciate that whoever has written me the email, raise their hand and tell me what the issues are. One guy did. The guy who had written the email. In a public forum. And I was ready to get humiliated. I think that was the key. The fact that I was okay with that, right? And he gave me great feedback. I learned some of my leadership from him. I had done a performance review of my directs and they came back and they said, you've done just a very horrible, demotivating job of what you have done, right? So to be able to take that in the right context, it keeps going back. Are you self-aware? Are you willing to learn? Lot of things cannot be taught. They have to be learned, right? So I would say the ones who scale know that. Now, in a different context, the question is, should founders leave companies? I'm a big believer of founder-run companies. Whether you look at Amazon, Tencent, Alibaba, Google, Facebook, the companies that have really scaled were all founder-run. The best founders figure out early, like what I was saying, where they need help. Mark Zuckerberg got Sheryl. Larry and Sergey got Eric Schmidt. Bezos got nobody. But Bezos was a little bit more seasoned when he started, right? So I think, and by the way, originally Steve Jobs got John Sculley. Then obviously he got John Sculley fired, but that is separate, right? So I think the best ones are extremely self-aware, very willing to learn and change. Do organizations grow? Sometimes some of them will not be able to scale. And I think there, again, if the self-awareness is there, they will hand it over to somebody.
Got it.
So on this point of, you know, scaling with the company, like I said, there has to be that self-awareness and there has to be kind of a ruthless desire to learn and get better and personally improve without ego. So the other piece, I spoke about leadership. The other piece was, frankly, I didn't know what strategy meant. I went for a HBS reunion in 2003 and attended one class with Rob Kaplan on strategy focused organizations, and it was a eureka moment. I would argue that was one of the inflection points for Bazi, because we came back, Suvir and I, and we took an offsite, went off, figured all of that stuff out. But again, there was a ruthless desire to learn, and the teacher could have taught, but we, I think, you know, implemented it really well.
Got it. Back to entrepreneurs that you back. I mean, the Wi-Fi password here is founders first. So what do you mean by that? And what do you look for in founders? Are there three or four traits of an entrepreneur that you look for and how do you look for them?
So I would say there are in venture investing, everybody will say that they invest in a team and a market.
Right.
The rub comes when you have to pick one over the other. So it's a shitty market, a great team will you do it. Or it's a great market, but the team is not up to your standards of some sort. Great team, great market, great. And probably it'll be overpriced.
Good
and
problem to have,
nobody will make money. So the when we have to make that trade-off, we trade off on the side of founders, right? We have a philosophical viewpoint, and I've seen that happen even in our portfolio, that the best founders are not here to waste time. If the market doesn't play out the way they think it was playing, they was going to play out, they'll create a new market. Facebook almost create, well, actually Facebook, the market was trying to try to be pioneered by Friendster and MySpace and all of that, and look at what Mark Zuckerberg did, right? And social networking didn't exist at the market. So they create stuff. That's how we are founders first. Now that has multiple implications. We try to back the best guys, but to your earlier point about how we work with them is also critical. You can't back the best guys and then go and say, do this, do that. Then it is the intrusion point that you are making.
Yep.
So how we work with them is also founders first. We put them first.
Interesting.
We have an internal framework called FIMM. F-I-M-M. Founders, Investors, Matrix, Me. That's the value system. And their founders are again first. The second part of your question was?
No, I think it was just, what do you look for?
Well, I wish we knew. See, there is an art to this business. If there is ever an art, that is the art. Now, again, I'm a big believer you can learn over a period of time. I think my own people evaluation skills were average. Today I would think they are better. And that has happened over a period of time. It's more easy for us to spot things that are negative than things that will make somebody a great investor. So I would say we have this category of where we say we are not going to invest. That's easier to get to. Maybe integrity, maybe capability, maybe something. It's always a combination of attitude plus aptitude, right? And there are things we look for. We look for hard work, hustle, but anything I tell you, you are going to say that sounds obvious, right? The question is, and I think where the art comes in, is there will always be some positives and always be some negatives. How do you put it all together? And in that story, is it a yes or no? Ultimately, investing is about saying a yes or a no.
It's about the judgment, right?
It is that judgment. And judgment is the hardest part of this business. That judgment where you say yes or a no, right? That part is not scientifically something you can put down. Now, there are tools we use. And again, it goes back to the outside-in view of the world. Reference checks. Go spend time with them in the market. Go spend time with them on the product rather than sitting in your room and, you know, creating analysis or models.
Got it.
But those are just proxies.
Fair enough. And again, just if you take stock of life, it's been a decade plus in investing.
Sadly, yeah.
How do you think about life ahead, right? I think back to the $55 million point where, you know, a lot of your financial needs were met, you moved on, you got into investing. How do you think about what the goalpost should be for yourself?
I think the goalpost is very clearly for the last decade also, it's just pure achievement. And in my own way, not maybe in a more broader sense of the term, but impact. So for me, the impact is if, personally speaking, the way I think of myself and then some version of that permeates throughout the firm, if I could be involved with creating 10 plus billion dollar companies, you know, right now the count is maybe two or three on the way, whatever. Involved in creating, I'm not talking about the money made, right? Just that impact, the thought partnership with those entrepreneurs. For me, that is what drives us. I would say as a firm, therefore, we think about we should be in business. Should we have 30 to 50% market share of the best founders over the next decade? We think the market share of market cap will follow.
Very interesting.
Because that's our approach, right? So we are really, really founders first in that regard. And frankly, that's what drives us.
And which element of entrepreneurship do you think is least understood? You know, given the, let's say, the excitement around entrepreneurship as a concept, as a theme, a lot of people taking the plunge straight out of IIT Bombay and a few other places. In your experience, where do you think Where do you see people having a blind spot? Which element of entrepreneurship is often least understood in your experience?
I don't know if it's least understood, because you did mention it earlier. I think maybe the resilience part of it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the other things you'll see in normal management or business textbooks, but just that character. And I would say resilience, even in the face of adversity, is probably theoretically understood, not practically internalized when people start it. And then when it hits them, then that's when they realize.
And maybe that's sort of an interesting juncture to talk about
your
episode in the context of what happened at eBay.
Yeah.
And also recently, I think the Stazila founder went through a tough tough situation.
Yeah.
So what does resilience mean in practical terms for an entrepreneur?
Perseverance in the face of adversity. And it's a very simple definition, right? And I would say there is this poem by Rudyard Kipling, which I just got reminded of the other day when I was reading, hearing somebody else's podcast. And that poem used to be it used to really motivate me. Mm-hmm. And it talks about how, I don't know if you've read the poem, but it talks about how essentially you can go from rags to riches, and let that not affect you, and then throw it all away and let not that affect you. And the reason that if is that if you can do this, then the last line is you'll be a man, my son. Right. And that really has always resonated with me. And it's probably something I'll give to my son when he's whatever, 16. So to me, that equanimity, having this drive, this passion, and getting in day in and day out and doing stuff, yet when the cheese gets moved, to have that maturity, that gravitas, that equanimity, whatever it is, to be able to switch context and handle that situation. I think that's what separates the men from the boys.
And specifically large institutions, Avnish, as entrepreneurs, you're always often opening doors which are much bigger than you, or dealing with institutions which are often much bigger than you. So any insights on how to deal with such situations? For example, legal system is one, right? Where you feel like an inconsequential pawn when these things happen.
Yeah.
So any insights on just how to deal with these large institutions when you go through these phases?
So I think one of the things that we have not done well enough, even in my experience, I realized that post facto, is that one has to think about the fact that one operates in an ecosystem. And some concept of risk management. And some concept of... And by the way, this is not just India. eBay, when they pioneered the model in the US, Meg Whitman, I think, had an arrest warrant or there was some inquiry for some gun sold in New York, state of New York, on the site. So the models were not understood. And then there was a new legislation that came in. So I think recognizing these things upfront, maybe therefore having some stakeholder management over there is important. And it's very easy for us to say this is India and it's a banana republic, which often it is. But to actually be able to recognize that this is part of doing business in a disruptive model. And you have to slowly educate people about that disruption. I do think that's something that people should know.
Back to that super forecasting, right? You need to forecast risk as well.
Exactly.
Got it. Just wrapping up, a couple of questions, Avnish. One thing is, you went to Harvard Business School. In your experience, what are the three things that you wish they taught you at HBS? But they didn't.
I mean, there's so many. I could have a podcast on just, what all I have learned post facto.
Sure.
Now, that is not a ding on HBS.
Of course.
Because for me, I owe a lot of who I am today to HBS. I call it you go in, and you go into a ringer and you come out and you're a transformed person and you can't pinpoint why. And that's what HBS did to me. But I didn't know what leadership really meant. I didn't know what strategy really meant. I don't know what execution really meant. Now, these sound like standard management 101 things that you can teach in business school, right? It's very hard to figure it out even in a case method, right? That in execution, you should be setting simple things like management practices, like what you should need to have one-on-ones. You need to have things that where, you know, circle back, align incentives, all of that stuff. It's all theory until you practice, right? Mm. So I sometimes wonder whether people who go back to these, you know, executive ed might actually be taking away more from it. So these would fall in the bucket of the three things that technically as part of business school, but actually can't really be taught. Mm. But if you ask me, these are not the big things. This is one of those things where I say, you know, you can teach certain things and you can learn certain things. These you can actually teach and get people can learn. Then there is the people angle, the empathy, the fact that everybody has to figure out their balance of EQ and IQ, which is a, you know, continuous journey for most of us. I don't think that can be taught, even if HBS tried. The judgment. Ultimately, life is about judgment. Success or the lack thereof can ultimately be traced back to a series of decisions that were made over a point of time or period of time. And at each one of those is a yes or a no.
Correct.
And that or a maybe, which is the worst answer. And the yes or a no is judgment.
True.
Right? How do you teach that? But you can learn it. And I think you can learn it by always pattern matching things that are happening around you and seeing what is a high correlation to success and where you are correlating. And it's very hard to explain. Therefore, I said it is, you know, something that can be learned. But I think life ultimately comes down to judgment.
It's very interesting you say this. The final piece is this podcast is titled Play to Potential. And I think just like in businesses, the two questions that they often have to answer coherently over a period of time is where to play and how to win. And even as individuals think about their life and career, often those are the two questions. Where to play is what should I do with my life? And how to win is how do I do a good job of whatever I choose to do? So in summary, Avnish, any headline thoughts on just how people should reflect on these two questions as they
So we had discussed this in one of the earlier part of this interview, which is the passion, skill set, opportunity framework, right? I have used it myself. I have seen a lot of people using it. As it turns out, I was reading one of the Japanese books. By the way, I think one of the best ways of growing in life is to read a lot.
Ikigai is a term.
I think it's called Ikigai, right? And but they have four. They have four, which is meaning.
Yeah.
And I remember my Bazi parting talk was about four pillars of life. And now when, you know, you can always put it in frameworks. So I do think that where to play is at the intersection of passion, skill set, and opportunity. And just, you know, on a lighter note, if you're at passion and skill set, but no opportunity, you'll be happy, but poor. And you can go with each of these and you can come up with
some optimality too.
Yeah. So I think at the intersection is where to play.
And if I may double click on that, Avnish, see, skill set often is visible. It's on the CV. Opportunity is often visible. It's the market. How do you decode passion? What's been your experience in figuring that out? Because I see some people.
I am going to give you a very cliched answer. I think it's the shower test. What you're pursuing. I mean, would you, and by the way, we asked this to some of our entrepreneurs. If you had all the money in the world, what would you be doing? That's your passion. If I had all the money, by my definition, I have all the money in the world. Now, because I don't need more than this. I would be doing what I'm doing. That's my passion, right? So to me, that is the test, right? Now, I would also probably be teaching. And therefore, there is somewhere in the back of the mind, that agenda.
Got it. Lovely, Avnish. Thank you so much for your time and for your candor. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Deepak.
Enjoyed the chat. What would you do with your time if you had all the money in the world? It's an interesting way of framing the problem and looking at the options in front of you. It's a similar insight that came up in my conversation with the stand-up comedian Papa CJ, who pursued an MBA from Oxford and then was a management consultant, but then chucked it to become a stand-up comedian. He talks about a similar issue where he says that if you had $1 billion in the bank, what would you do with your time? That's the key question, especially when you're at crossroads. Hope you found the conversation purposeful. I look forward to having you in one of my subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit audioboom.com and look for Play to Potential or subscribe in iTunes. Bye now.